Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. We got the Fed, we got gross domestic product, and we got good advice from bad people. Yes, we do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday it is, today the 30th of April. Great to have you with us, everybody. And listen, on a day when the Commerce Department told us that gross domestic product, that is the economy basically, grew at a microscopic annualized rate of 0.1% last quarter, I got some news for you. There is going to come a time, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon-ish, when the United States will not have the biggest economy on the planet. And in point of fact, a New World Bank report says that could happen real soon, end of this year maybe, depending on how you measure. That would be and is a big deal, but you are not hearing much about it from China. Nary a peep, one might say. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains why Beijing doesn't want the world to think it's on top.
China tends to downplay news like this because of global politics, says Peterson Institute senior fellow Nicholas Lardy.
It certainly puts pressure on them to do more in the international arena.
When the numbers say you're a bigger deal, other countries push you harder to give aid, change trade policy, and stop screwing around with your currency. Dartmouth Business School Associate Dean Matt Slaughter explains that rising in the ranks also brings attention to Chinese industrial pollution.
The faster is China's growth, the more the world legitimately looks to China for any meaningful carbon reduction.
China also worries about how economic news plays domestically, where hundreds of millions still live in poverty. Yale finance professor Ziwu Chen says trumpeting strong growth numbers wouldn't go over well at home.
The Chinese government usually reacts in a very quiet way because they realize that China overall is still a developing and poor country.
And remember, Lardy adds, China tops another important chart.
All of these measures are, in a sense, a little bit artificial because they're a function to a considerable extent of the fact that China has 1.3 billion people.
Spread over its giant population, the swelling GDP isn't much per person. Milken Institute Managing Director Perry Wong says that doesn't mean officials aren't stoked about economic growth.
To be ranked number one, they may celebrate, I think, in private.
So any champagne or Mao Tai toasts probably won't be done on camera. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Nor should they be with the Mao Tai, let me tell you. There were no surprises at all from the Federal Open Market Committee today. The taper, that is, cuts to the Fed's stimulus program, continues apace. Interest rates are going to stay exactly where they are. But there is some suspense among Fed watchers when it comes to wondering just when the vacancies on the Fed's Board of Governors are going to be filled. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
It's lonely at the top, but this is getting ridiculous.
We've never had a situation like we're in now.
That's Peter Conti Brown, a fellow at Stanford who's writing a history of the Fed. Here's the situation he's talking about. There are supposed to be 7 Fed governors, but right now there are just 4. 3 nominees are waiting for Senate confirmation. Conti Brown says politics is part of the problem.
Part of it is certainly the culture of gridlock between Senate Republicans and the Obama administration.
The gridlock is leading to an imbalance on the Fed's Open Market Committee. They're the people who actually vote on whether to raise interest rates or buy more bonds. All those empty Fed governor seats are giving more power to the other people on the committee, the presidents of 5 regional Fed banks. Ken Kuttner is a former Fed economist who now teaches economics at Williams College.
The presidents have staked out their own points of view. Often you'd get 1 or 2 regional bank presidents who could always be counted on to dissent.
All this makes it harder for the stock and bond markets to predict what the Fed will do, and they hate uncertainty. Stuart Hoffman is also a former Fed economist. He's now chief economist at PNC. He says, yeah, there'll be more debate at the Fed, but everybody has the same goal.
It's not like you have different ends. You might just have some different means to the common end.
But Hoffman says it would be best to fill the empty Fed slots soon, especially since there will be another vacancy on the Fed board in just a month. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, slow start, strong finish, kind of. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Think back 3, 4, maybe 5 years and try real hard to remember how many bankers have gone to jail for their role in the financial crisis. Go ahead, take as long as you want, but you're not going to get it. The answer is not, surprisingly, none. It is actually the loneliest number. One, a guy who worked at Credit Suisse whose name you wouldn't recognize, who is doing 30 months in prison. Jesse Eisinger has the story of why it is just one in the New York Times Magazine this coming Sunday. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You point out pretty high up in this piece that the American financial cycle basically goes boom, bust, and then a crackdown. It's happened that way for 100 years, yet there hasn't been the crackdown after the Great Recession and the financial crisis.
Right. And I tried to set out to figure out why. And my answer is that it's not a conspiracy. There wasn't the whisper from on high from Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner to Eric Holder that they couldn't prosecute the banks. It turns out that there are reasons why the Department of Justice has effectively lost its ability to meaningfully indict corporations or go after individuals at the highest echelons of corporate America.
One begins with a little case that a lot of us are familiar with, Enron and Arthur Andersen.
Yes. So Arthur Andersen, they actually indicted the company. And the Department of Justice learned its lesson, or in my view, overlearned its lesson to be extremely cautious, overly cautious in my view, about indicting corporations.
Yeah. And Arthur Andersen gets shut down basically by this indictment. The tens of thousands of people lose their job. And then the Supreme Court 2 years later overturns it.
Yes. Now, I can understand that I have a lot of sympathy for many of the people who lost their jobs. The Supreme Court ruling is an interesting one because it didn't say that Arthur Andersen was not guilty of the crime that they had been indicted for, yeah, which was obstruction of justice. It revolved around jury instructions. But the Department of Justice took this as a huge black eye and embarrassment and, as I say, overlearned the lesson that they can't do this again.
Is there, based on all your reporting and you know, your sense of this stuff, is there a desire for people to go to jail, or are the American people, let's get over this and move on?
I think there was certainly outrage about it. Now I think there's a deep sense of resignation about the impunity with which corporate executives can act, and I think that's deeply troubling. I'm also troubled that the Department of Justice hasn't grappled in any way with any view that they didn't do what was proper. Now, if you actually talk to individual prosecutors, they will say, I'm stunned no criminal cases came out of the financial crisis. I just didn't see any of them myself. And so that's, I think, the first step to admitting you have a problem, but we need to get to the second step.
You know, it's interesting that your piece is released. It's coming out in the magazine this Sunday. It comes out online today. It is out online today. It's interesting that it comes out on the day when the lead article in the paper is about prosecutors contemplating charges against Credit Suisse and BNP Paribas for non-financial crisis-related misdeeds.
Yes, I thought that was very interesting too. I think that they're cognizant of their reputation. Of course, they knew my piece was coming at some point because I ran everything by them and we had extensive discussions about it. I think we will have to see if this is going to be the case. And what we want to see from prosecutors is to punish the guilty, not to punish the innocent, to have meaningful guilty pleas from corporations if they do seek that. And then we really want to see individuals, because the real bad actors are the top officers in companies that commit crimes, and you have to go after them successfully if you want to deter white-collar crime.
Jesse Eisinger, he's a senior reporter at ProPublica. His piece on why no bankers have gone to jail for the financial crisis, except one guy, is in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday. It's online right now. Jesse, thanks very much.
Thanks very much. It was great.
This is so not the week to be a school kid in the great state of New York. Third through eighth graders there are going to be chained to their desks taking state math tests. They did English language arts just a month ago. Tests that are aligned with the Common Core, the standardized curriculum that's been adopted by more than 40 states. But the core itself and the tests as well are increasingly under attack by everybody from teachers to politicians. This is, in New York, the second year of the tests, and Dan Bobkoff reports that some parents are so against them, they're having their kids just sit them out.
Last year, Amelia Costigan watched as her twin sons and their fourth grade classmates got ready for the new state tests and literally worried themselves sick.
My kids had trouble sleeping. Other kids had stomach aches. Their kids were going to the doctors. The doctors were saying it looked like it was stress from the test.
The tests were the definition of high stakes. They determined whether her sons advanced to the next grade or got into a top middle school. Test scores also played into teacher evaluations and school rankings. Costigan and the parents of eight other kids at her school decided they didn't want their kids to participate.
It was a hard decision that some of them had. They cried. They worried they weren't going to go to graduation. But in the end, all 10 kids did opt out.
Parents groups estimate about 1,000 kids in New York City won't be taking these Common Core assessments this year. Statewide, it's about 35,000. Those numbers are hard to verify and are a tiny fraction of the total number of kids sitting down for the math test this week. But opting out is the most drastic, invisible part of a growing protest movement in New York and nationwide.
Less testing,
more teaching.
Parents, teachers, and other critics have been holding rallies like this one in Lower Manhattan. Parent Andrea Mata comes to the mic.
We're here today to say not one more year. We do not want another year where the entire school year is taken up with test prep.
Liz Rosenberg says her fourth grade daughter wasn't scared of the test at first.
She was super psyched to take it.
But Rosenberg was anything but psyched. Part of her objection is that the questions and answers are not released after the test, so it's hard for kids to know what they don't know. She convinced her daughter that the tests are a bad idea, so this year she's opting out.
It's important to stand up. It's important to talk back.
Many teachers and critics believe the math is confusing and the English questions are too hard. Fourth graders being asked to assess middle school level reading. It's the English test that turned Elizabeth Phillips into a critic. She's principal at PS 321 in Brooklyn. She's not anti-testing or even against the Common Core, but she says,
we felt that the questions did not actually assess whether children were reading with understanding, which we believe is very important to assess.
Phillips was also concerned that so much was riding on these tests. Like other critics, she held protests. And to some degree, it worked.
Up until really a few weeks ago, there was a lot at stake.
In the past few weeks, New York officials have been scrambling to lower the stakes. No longer will test scores go on students' permanent records, and they won't be used as the major determinant of whether kids go on to the next grade. Emily Weiss of the New York City Department of Education thinks that change will go a long way to placate many nervous parents.
Knowing that the state test will only be used as one of multiple factors has eased a lot of those concerns.
At some point, if too few students take the test, some schools could lose funds. That's still far off, but with opposition to the test mounting, New York's fight could be coming to a state near you. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Coming up, seeking self-help? Well, caveat emptor.
Often the people who we look to for wisdom are often terrible at following their own advice.
Good advice from bad people, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 45 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 16,580. The NASDAQ advanced 11 points. That is 0.25%, ended things at 41.14. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 1/3%, closed at 18.83. The online review service Yelp shrugged off 1% today ahead of its earnings release today. Facebook showing up 2.8%, 2.8%. Microblogging firm Twitter, though, tumbled 8.5% today, gained fewer users in the first quarter than analysts had guessed. Battery giant Energizer hopped up 14.3% today after announcing plans to separate its household products and personal care divisions into two separate companies. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.64%. And you? You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday, May 1st. Really? Is it May already? In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on how much we earned and how much left our wallets in March. It releases its personal income and spending report. Automakers are scheduled to release sales figures for April. And people, May is National Bike Month. It's also National Salad Month. Why don't we just call it Get Ready for Swimsuit Season Month? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Los Angeles Clippers are up 3-2 over the Golden State Warriors. They won last night on a big day for the team. Owner Donald Sterling has been banned from the NBA for life, and Commissioner Adam Silver is going to try to force him to sell the team. But it's not exactly going to be a fire sale here. A handful of very wealthy people have expressed interest already. The question is, how much are they going to have to pay? Sally Herships has that story.
To figure out how much a sports team is worth, first you have to know why buyers want to buy. There are the traditional reasons.
I mean, you can go back to the 19th century. People would buy baseball teams because they owned a tavern nearby and they wanted to sell their beer.
Michael Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University. He says nowadays, owners are more likely to buy shares in media networks. But payoff for ownership can come in different forms.
When you own a sports franchise, you join a very exclusive club. As George Steinbrenner once said, before I bought the Yankees, I was just some shipbuilder in Tampa.
Leeds says there's a rush that comes with seeing your name in the paper, and some buyers are willing to pay a premium for that. Celebrities from David Geffen to Oprah Winfrey are reported to be interested in buying the LA Clippers, and all that buzz can drive prices up.
There is a huge cushion of unpredictability based on the interest this has generated.
Kevin Zanny is with Willamette Management Associates, an investment valuation firm. He says a good way to determine a franchise's value is to look at similar sales, like the recent deal for the LA Dodgers for $2 billion. Zanny says that's 8 times the team's revenue.
If you applied those same metrics to the Clippers, you would have a $1 billion sale.
Donald Sterling bought the team for only $12 million. Zanny says owning a sports team for the long term will mean the biggest score for investors. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
With apologies to Gertrude Stein, rice is not rice is not rice. Various cuisines have their own preferred varieties. Basmati for Indian food, arborio for risottos, that kind of thing. The sweet, sticky rice that comes with your sushi most likely comes from California. Almost all the medium grain rice eaten in this country does. About half of the crop goes for export. But the drought we are having out here might take a chunk out of production. And markets being what they are, mere speculation along those lines is already driving up prices. From Capital Public Radio, Amy Quinton reports.
97% of California's rice is grown in the Sacramento Valley. At Montana Farms, a huge drag scraper levels a field in preparation for planting. Nicole Van Vleck says medium grain rice will grow here, which is perfect for sushi.
So if you're eating sushi rice in New York or in Florida or San Francisco, you're most likely, you know, undoubtedly going to be eating California rice.
Van Vleck stands next to a water pump that's flooding the field behind her.
So this is water that's coming from the Feather River, and the Feather River is just due east of us, and we divert out of the Feather.
Northern California farmers typically have plenty of water compared to those in the south, even during dry years. But Dan Sumner says not this year. He's an agriculture economist at the University of California, Davis.
This is the first time I know of where we cut back rice acreage because surface water allocations were cut so severely to water districts north of Sacramento.
Montana Farms has been in the Sacramento Valley for generations, but this is the first time a drought has caused so much uncertainty.
It's unlike anything I've ever had to deal with day to day. Things change. Right now, we are down 48% over last year.
Rice farmers will leave 100,000 acres of their fields fallow. That's a big deal. Van Vleck says medium grain rice grows in just a few places around the world.
If you have California being reduced, and California does export at least about half of their crop. And so if California is affected because of the drought, it all of a sudden changed the price of medium grain substantially.
Dan Sumner has already seen the price increase.
Farmers were getting between $15 and $20 a sack of rice. That's a 100-pound sack of rice. It's now up in the range of $25 or $30 or more.
Customers have seen the price bump at Odo's Marketplace in Sacramento. The store specializes in Asian foods. Russell Odo is the general manager. He says by the time the increase trickles down to the customer, it will only be slight.
A lot of the distributors and everybody, you know, went in increments. So it wasn't that you don't see a big price raise all at one time. But by May or June, it might go up a little bit more from what my prices are now.
What worries rice farmers like Van Vleck the most is the possibility that California could see more dry years ahead.
We have this wonderful system of customers that count on us each and every year. And I don't know that they'll all be able to be serviced this year. Someone else will fill that void. You might not get the customer back.
And economists say that's the danger. Suppliers might just start buying their rice elsewhere, like Australia or Arkansas. The drought may send a signal to the world market that California rice isn't reliable. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton for Marketplace.
Oprah Winfrey and Starbucks have partnered up, as you may have heard, which explains how I've got one of those cardboard hot drink sleeve things on my desk that's got a pearl of wisdom from Oprah printed on it. The only courage you ever need, it says, is the courage to live the life you want, which is great if you're Oprah and you never have to worry about the mortgage and all the rest. Author Zach Bissonette has been browsing the self-help book aisle, noticing the, shall we say, inconsistencies between advice givers and their own personal behavior. He's put together his own slim volume of that advice. It's called Good Advice from Bad People. Zach, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to go straight to the introduction in this book. The question, of course, is where shall wisdom be found? not with these people in this book, man.
Well, I think there's a little bit of wisdom. I mean, the
little
maybe
tiny
bit from unlikely sources. The idea of the book, you know, it struck me sort of about a year ago how easy it is to become an inspirational icon or, you know, a self-help expert and that kind of thing, and how often the people who we look to for wisdom are often terrible at following their own advice.
And it's lucrative too, right? I mean, you say right here in the intro, $11 billion on self-improvement products in 2008.
Right, and half of that's probably Tony Robbins, but there's still room for a lot of other people.
To be serious for 1 second before we get into lampooning these people, that some of the need for self-help, I mean, people actually feel this stuff, right? They want it, they're looking for it, and they turn to these people.
Yeah, and that's a question I had was, you know, does it in a way really matter, you know, that, for instance, the two sort of founders of the advice column in America, Ann Landers and Dear Abby, were two sisters, and they were not on speaking terms for most of their lives. They had a horrific relationship, and yet they provided advice that a lot of people, I think, derived some value from. You know, so does it matter that they were sort of hypocritical in most ways?
Yeah, clearly not, because as you say, and this is a quote, in our desperate need for motivational figures, we make almost no effort to vet them.
My favorite example of this would be, you know, someone like Lance Armstrong, you know, who's in the subtitle of the book, who, you know, we were just told constantly he was so inspiring. He was such a hero. And, you know, about all we knew about him was that he rode a bicycle really fast and that he, you know, had a prognosis that allowed him to come back from testicular cancer and do that, which is great. But was there anything there to really show that this was a person of high character? And when you go back and sort of look at the record, you know, no, there wasn't. He just told us he was, and we believed him.
All right, we will start with a guy for whom I personally believe there is a special place in hell reserved. His name is Donald Trump, and he says, you have to be confident as you face the world each day, but you can't be too cocky. Anybody who thinks he's going to win them all is going to wind up a huge loser. I believe this man still thinks he's going to be president, for crying out loud.
That line from Donald Trump comes from his book, Trump Surviving at the Top, which he got the contract for right at the height of his Art of the Deal power. Mm-hmm. And by the time the book came out in 1991, Donald Trump's empire was in serious trouble, born of his own sort of narcissism and overconfidence.
Here's another one. When you know what you are talking about, others will follow you because it is safe to follow you. None other than the CEO, the former CEO, we should say, of Lehman Brothers, Richard Fuld, in 2006. Hello? Follow you?
Almost exactly 2.5 years before the bankruptcy. What's funny about that, most of the sort of CEOs that I found, they were cultivating personality-driven brands right at the sort of apex of their careers, right before it all goes to hell.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think in order to be these guys, it takes a certain lack of self-awareness where these guys are not able to see their own hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. They're just so into their own sort of power that, you know, you confront them and it's like, oh.
And it sounds just like that, too.
It sounds exactly that. That is verbatim.
It is called Good Advice from Bad People by Zach Bissonnette. Zach, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Bitcoin edition. First of all, in what may well be a sign of the cryptocurrency's slow rise to relevance, Bloomberg is going to start tracking the Bitcoin dollar exchange rate on its data terminal. So that's news. Also, though, and frankly more interesting, every undergraduate at MIT is going to get $100 in Bitcoin thanks to the MIT Bitcoin Club. They raised $500,000 from alumni and, quote, the Bitcoin community to, quoting again, spur academic and entrepreneurial activity. You can quote me on this. Every MIT undergrad just got $100. $100. All right. That's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. $100 as an undergrad. Come on, right? I'd have killed for that. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.